For members only, Golf Smarter number 286, published on June 7, 2011.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Understanding course design can lower your scores with Jeff Beyer.
This is Golf Smarter. Sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Our guest today is Jeff Beyer, PGA head professional at the Westin Mission Hills in Palm Desert, California. Welcome to Golf Smarter for members only, Jeff.
Hi, Fred. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for joining us today. And you are now working down in the Palm Springs area for a couple of Troon courses. It's a resort with two 18-hole courses.
That's correct.
And it's interesting. You have... And they're not even as if like they have interesting names, other than the fact that they're touting the fact that they're a Gary Player course and a Pete Dye course.
Yeah, it's nice to have two distinctly different golf courses, you know, under one resort. So it's really nice, a pleasure working here, you know, and I think all the guests really like having two options to play at as well.
And how much of it is the business there is generated by guests, and how much are locals coming out and playing?
Well, I'll tell you, it's kind of a unique situation that we're in. The local residents actually prefer the Gary Player course. The Gary Player course is actually about a mile away from the resort, and so it's a little bit easier in, easier out. But also, even though it's a touch longer in distance than the Pete Dye, it's actually a little bit more player-friendly. So the locals prefer this one here at the Gary Player. And so I would say at the Gary Player specific, in the winter time, it's probably 60 to 70% local residents, and then about 40-45% resort guests. Whereas the Pete Dye, which is right on resort property, you walk out your door and you're on the golf course, probably 80%, 90% resort guests. So it's an interesting dynamic, to say the least.
Yeah, and you're saying that, you know, it's a little bit longer and stuff. Still, the rating and slope on these courses are not that high. I mean, it's not. They're not very difficult courses. We talked about that when we initially started the conversation to have you on the show. We were talking about the two different courses, and you were telling me, well, you know, it's a little bit longer course. And then I looked at the scorecard and went, wait a minute, the golds are like 124 or something. It's not that difficult of a course.
Yeah, no, and that's kind of the interesting part of the golf course is the Pete Dye is a par 70, and it is maxed out at 6,600 yards, whereas the Gary Player can be stretched out a little bit further to 7,200 as a par 72, but definitely a little bit more wide open, a little bit more player-friendly around the greens as well, which is why they're a little bit similar as far as their slope and rating. And they are. I mean, there's no question about it. It's a resort course, so... Certainly the goal is not to beat up golfers when they come out and experience it.
No, of course not, because you want them to come back. Why? What should a golfer, a recreational golfer, it's always the way I ask questions in the sense of a recreational golfer, but what should we look at when we're trying to figure out how to strategically play a course? Should we be looking at the distance, or should we be looking at the rating slope?
Well, I would say a little bit of both, actually. And, you know, I'll kind of use these two courses as an example because of how distinctly different they are. If you were to look at the Pete Dye and the Gary Player, looking at the slope rating, the slope and the rating, they're going to be very similar. However, now you look at the distance, and like I said before, the Pete Dye is a little bit shorter. So what does that really mean? To me, that means that the Pete Dye is going to be a little bit more difficult shot maker's course, I'll call it. So off the tee box, you may not be hitting driver all day, and around the greens, it may be a little bit more demanding. Where if you come over and play the Gary Player course, slope and rating, again, the same, just longer. So you would tend to lean towards the side of, it's probably a little more player-friendly off the tee box, and the greens are probably less undulating, which is true, actually. So, I like to use both distance and slope and rating to decide what tee boxes you want to play. And again, having four tee boxes at each golf course and a combo set for both men and women, even if you did think it was too difficult here or there, you could always adjust and make it a little bit easier if you felt like it was necessary.
I think the more people look at the distance of the course, you know, when I people pick up a scorecard and they go right to what the distance is and think that that's going to make a difference in their game, and they don't realize that, you know, if it's got a slope of like a 124 versus a 136, that's going to have a huge impact on their how many strokes that they put up.
That's right, and it's always nice to, if you're not sure, or even if you're a single digit handicap, it's always good to ask a recommendation from the professional staff, and most of the time they're going to be blunt because they want you to enjoy your experience. But also, if you're a good player, they'll tell you which tee box to play, whether it's a combo setter or all the way back. Most professional staffs will tell you right up front what tees you should be playing. So if you're indecisive, or even a starter or a ranger on the golf course, they'll tell you that too. So always use local knowledge if you can.
Would you please explain to us the difference between rating and slope? So many people don't even have a clue, including I try to explain it, and then when I start to, I realize, wait a minute, this can't be right. That just doesn't make sense.
I'll tell you, I do the best I can for you. And I'll use the layman term because even as a golf professional, it is a complicated math-oriented arithmetic process that a dozen people come out and rate your golf course. And we're actually having ours re-rated at the end of the month, which is the only reason I recently have heard about it. The way that I use it, and I explain it to our guests, is the rating on a golf course, I compare it to your handicap. So, for example, if a course rating is 72 and the par is 72 at that golf course and you're a 10 handicap, generally speaking, you're going to shoot an 82. Okay. Now, if the golf course is a rating of 75 and you're a 10 handicap, that says you're probably going and you're playing those tee boxes that are rated for a 75 and you're a 10 handicap, that's telling you you're probably going to shoot 85. Okay, so that shows you the level of degree of difficulty on the golf course. And a really good example is I had an opportunity to play Whistling Straits a few years ago, and the course rating from they called them the PGA tees, was an 80. And I was a scratch golfer at the time, and I shot 79. And I felt like I played as good as I could, and rightfully so, because the score that I posted was a plus one compared to the rating on the golf course. And slope, I don't want to be quoted on it, but I will say that it's a level of difficulty of the golf course. And how they come up with that number, I am not 100% sure on, but I do know it is a degree of difficulty. Like you even said, but difference between a 120 and a 135, obviously the 135 is going to be more difficult. How they come up with that number, however, I'm not 100% sure.
So it has nothing to do with being a bogey golfer or... Your explanation so far has been like, oh, okay.
It's like, when the USGA comes out and rate the golf course, they'll have a few different angles that they do. What they'll do is they'll come out and they'll walk the course, look at distances, look at the placement of bunkers, water hazards, trees. They'll even look at the length of your rough and do things like that. But what they'll also do is play golf. And they bring a bogey golfer, roughly a 25 to 30 handicap, a single-digit handicap, and a scratch. And they'll all go out and play. And what they'll do is in the morning, they'll take a look at the golf course. It's all those different options. And they'll go out and play and see if what they noticed when they were driving around the course and walking it is the same as when they actually played it. And so from all that information, and again, I haven't sat right next to these people throughout the 2 days that it takes to rate a golf course. But I do know that they do all those processes and they'll measure hazards from the tee box and ladies and gentlemen and the combo tees and degree of difficulty in the greens and green speed. So as I keep rambling on and on, you see why it's kind of an arithmetic to it. It's pretty extensive.
Okay. Now I think I'm even more confused. No, your clarification, adding your handicap into the par, that makes sense.
Well, generally speaking,
that makes sense.
And everyone, if you play a little bit of golf and have played, in Nassau with the buddies or the gals, you ask the golf shop, what your handicap would be from this tee box. And that's, the rating sheet that we have, behind the golf shop counter is based off of the course rating.
And this is the way the USGA thinks this is the way it should be done to help people understand better how they should play a course.
Well, understand it. I don't know about that, but I can say that they try and make it fair, and it's a very complicated way of trying to make it fair, I guess. But so are the rules.
Good old USGA.
That's my favorite.
Do you find that most people play from the wrong tee boxes?
It depends. Let's take our Pete Dye course, for example.
Okay.
6,600 yards all the way back. for a ten handicap, 6,600 yards, maybe the one or even two up at their home course. Well, however, there's a reason it's our back tees. And the reason is because it's narrow, the greens are undulating. So if you go all the way back there and you take a 3-wood off the tee instead of your driver because you're more confident, well, you're going to have the same club you would have had playing your home course to a very difficult green. So sometimes I'll say ego gets in the way a little bit, depending on the golf course you're playing. And that's why I always tell people to ask for recommendations, whether it's the first tee starter or a ranger or the professional staff. You go in there and say, hey, I'm a 10 handicap. What do you recommend I play? And the first question I usually ask is, well, how far do you hit a tee shot? How accurate are you? And they'll say, well, you know, 225, 250, whatever the answer is, and not very or pretty accurate. And then, they'll give you a recommendation. And it's a much more enjoyable experience if you're okay. But it's one of those things for golfers. It's like asking for directions at a gas station. You know, you really don't want to do it because the ego's in the way. You know, and so, but I always recommend that if you're indecisive, go and ask somebody. And they'll tell you pretty straightforward exactly what you should be playing most of the time.
Then what should we keep Take two, Fred. Then what should we be keeping track of on our scorecard other than just strokes? Should we be...
In regards to,
if somebody asks me, well, how accurate are you? It's like, well, I'll hit 7 or 8 fairways.
Okay, yeah. I always, when I'm out on the lesson tee and I have a student that will come back once a week, we have a good relationship and they're trying to get better, and they ask me, well, how do I know I'm improving? And so I said, well, when you go out and practice, if you're by yourself or if you're with somebody else, take an extra scorecard with you. So, if I have Jeff on the top line, I'm keeping my score. Beneath that will be putts. And you just keep track of the number of putts that you have when you're on the putting green, not an inch off on the fringe because the PGA Tour and everybody else says that that's a chip. You keep track of your up and down.
Right. It's not how many strokes you hit with your putter. It's how many putts you have. Those are two different things, right?
That is correct. That's absolutely right. That's a good way to say it. I also tell them to keep track of their up and down. So when they miss a green, can they get it on the green in one putt? I also keep track of fairways hit and regulation and greens hit and regulation. And fairway hit and regulation is the 14 to 16 holes that you don't have a par 3 and you're hitting off of a tee box into a fairway. And from that point, if you can get on the green in 2 on a par 4 and 3 on a par 5. And keeping track of all those numbers and those, and after the round, you then compare it to... There's websites and applications that they come out with now, even on your iPhones, that you keep track of these statistics and it compares you with the average golfer or the professional golfer, or in my case, your instructor, so I can see if there is a level of improvement.
Excellent. Now, having a Gary Player course and a Pete Dye course, what is the difference as far as the architecture of a golf course?
Sure.
What is the difference between those two courses? Obviously, the terrain is basically the same. These two courses are less than, you're saying, is about a mile apart from one another. Uh-huh. So the terrain is basically the same. There's no hills. There's no mountains that we're walking up and down. They're fairly flat. You're in the desert.
Yep.
So what is it that it makes Gary Player course unique versus the Pete Dye?
You're going to laugh when I tell you this, but I'll
be the judge of that.
Well, now I'm laughing. But a few years ago, I spent a couple of days with Jack Nicklaus when he did a redesign of a former golf course I was at.
That's not fun.
And it was really an experience.
Wow.
And one of the things that he told me, we're walking down the fairway, and of course, one of the reasons we were doing a redesign is because the drainage wasn't working properly. And he said, Jeff, 75% of your golf course design anymore is drainage. 25% is the design. And so that to me kind of sparked a little bit of interest. And I thought, okay, well, let's look at the golf course that way then. You know, hills are going to be built and greens are going to be sloped. Well, if you go up to a putting green, for example, and you just look at, if I were to pour a cup of water over this putting green in a couple of different areas, where is it generally going to go? And 85% of the time, the break is going to go that way. And so it's just kind of interesting having that perspective on it. So if you now go to the Gary Player, for instance, the course that's about a mile off of the Westin Mission Hills resort property. It's a flatter terrain, a little bit more wide open. Now, why did he do that? Well, because generally speaking, it's a little bit longer than a lot of courses for a resort. You know, over 7,000 yards at a resort property, an annual golfer, I'll call it, it might be a little bit intimidated by that. But when you go to the first tee box and you see a fairway that's 40 yards wide and, you know, you don't have houses right on top of you and out of bounds is really nowhere in sight, all of a sudden you take a deep breath and you say, oh, okay, I think I can play the tee box that I want to play today. And then you go up, you know, from that perspective for the Gary Player signature course, and you go up to the greens. And, again, length involved, you might be hitting a shot instead of a pitching wedge. You may be hitting an 8-iron. So, you know, Gary, I'm sure, with that in mind, looks at the green complex and says, well, I can't make these extremely difficult because I already made the distance a little bit longer than a lot of resort courses. And, you know, the course was built 25 years ago. So 7,000 yards 20 years ago was as long as anyone does it. And so I'm sure that he made the greens a little bit fairer, bunkers not as deep. But at the same time, it's very interesting because there's some views from tee boxes and iron shots here that are really interesting with some rock formations and waterfalls. You know, not to mention you're hitting shots into a mountain with snow covered on it. That's a 20-minute drive from where we're at. So the Gary Player course, really interesting. But as far as golf course design goes, it's fair off a tee because I think it's longer, and especially 25 years ago, it was very long with the persimmon woods that they had back then, and probably just transitioning into steel. But then you take that and you transition over to the Pete Dye course. Now, you know, everyone asks me which do I prefer, and the answer for me personally is I prefer the Pete Dye, and like I said, the local residents prefer the Gary Player. The reason I like the Pete Dye is the first hole at the Dye is a very good example of why I like it. It's probably 375, 380 yards, and the prevailing wind is generally behind you. Now, you look at that and say, well, I could hit driver, and the answer is absolutely you could. However, if you hit a great driver and you're 60 yards, 70 yards from the green, you're on a severe downslope into a very narrow, undulating, difficult, firm green. And so you think, okay, well, that may not be the best play for me. So you scale back, that hybrid, that 3-wood, maybe even a 3-iron. And you hit that out there, leaves down a flat lie, all of a sudden a little bit better of an angle, into a difficult green. So the difference is instead of a lob wedge, you have a smooth pitching wedge in your hand. And so Pete Dye, I think, at this golf course, makes you think about the next shot ahead of you. Whereas the Gary Player, I always tell people, if you like to hit the driver, it's a good place to go because most of the time you're going to be hitting the driver. So that's the biggest difference for me in the two golf course designs, where when you go to play the Pete Dye, you're going to want to make sure you're thinking about that next shot. You get to kind of a chess game. What's going to give me the best opportunity for birdie on my next shot instead of let me just blast driver and give myself maybe a more difficult lie than if you were to lay it back a little bit.
Very interesting. I've always thought of playing golf like a chess game in the sense of when I'm standing at the tee box to figure out how I want to get to the flag. So I start at the flag and work with my way backwards, especially on a par five. Mm-hmm. It's like, where do I want to place this shot or attempt to place this shot to put myself in position to, you know, have the best club in my hand. It always amazes me how many, especially on par fives, how many people will just hit the ball as hard as they can, both on their first two shots, you know, driver and the next shot, as opposed to, like, I know that if I'm inside of 220 yards with no major, you know, and I'm on the fairway on a par five, and I'm on the fairway, I'm inside of 220, and there's no major distractions or obstructions in my way, like bunkers right in the front, you know, protecting the green, or water just to the right of the green type of thing, then I'll probably go for it. But if I'm, say I'm 250 out, then I will play it as 9-iron, 9-iron. I hit my 9-iron 125 yards. I'll play it 9-iron, 9-iron, trying to get, you know, take the risk-reward out of that, but also giving myself a shot that I'm much more confident about and that be in a position to try to get birdie on that hole by hitting my third shot as close to the pin as I can versus just trying to get it to the green and trying to get, you know, on in two and then two-putt for the birdie.
Yeah, and for the, you know, folks who are, you know, listening to this, instead of thinking, you know, hey, I'm a 30 handicap. How does this make sense for me? Let's look at the most simple hole as a par three. Okay.
Really? Is that the most simple hole?
It's supposed to be the simplest.
To me, sometimes that could be the hardest hole because you've got to nail that first shot.
Well, I'll tell you.
There's no room for
error.
There's less room for error on a par three.
And here's why I say it's interesting you say that, because I think it was Sam Snead who said, when you go up to a par three, you're going to put the tee in the ground. You're going to have a perfect lie, just like if you were to hit a drive right down the middle. Perfect lie. There's no complaint about that, and you're already in the middle of the fairway like you would be on a par four or par five. All you have to do then is hit the iron shot that you would on every other hole. He said that was, if you're ever going to birdie a hole, it should be every par three, because you have a perfect lie. There's no excuse.
Yeah, tell that to Tiger.
Yeah, well, I suppose. But anyway, if you look at a par three, mm-hmm. and you sit there and it's 150 yards to the pin, and it's right in the middle, and you know the golf course fairly well. Well, everyone usually would prefer an uphill putt if you're going to putt at birdie. So say it's a breezy day and you're in between clubs. You think your 8-iron will go a little bit past the pin, but you can lay off it a little bit. Or you can hit a good 9-iron, and even if you don't hit it that well, you're still going to be on the front part of the green putting uphill. Well, there's a very simple chess game there. Is I can make a mistake with my 8-iron, go long, and have a very difficult putt for birdie. Or I can do the same thing with my 9-iron and still be on the front of the green with an easy uphill putt, even if it is 20 feet. And so that's a chess game in its simplest form, is where do I want to leave my iron shot to give myself the easiest putt? Mm-hmm. You know, you were talking about par 5 and where you want to place your 9-irons. Same thing, you know, just looking at it from a little bit different perspective on a par 3.
Mm-hmm. If and I want to go back to another thing that you said about the 75% drainage, 25% design. If that is the case of how courses are being designed, should we follow the notion that, like, say on your course, everything's going to break towards the mountains? Everything's mm-hmm. going to, or you know, if you're playing on an ocean course or on a lake course, everything's going to break towards the water. Is that necessarily the case?
It depends on the area. You know, you go out to Scottsdale and you have four peaks, you know, out there to the northeast, and a lot of people in kind of Fountain Hills and east north Scottsdale will say, hey, everything breaks towards those mountains. Instead of if you were to go play Greyhawk or one of those courses that are kind of central south Scottsdale, where everything definitely breaks towards the valley. And if you think about that, it's a drainage more than just a golf course, where if everything breaks towards the valley, that's where the rain, when they do get rain, you know, that's where that's going to go.
When they turn on the sprinklers.
Yeah, exactly. Where's all the water going to go if the grass doesn't soak it up? It's got to go somewhere. All right. Now, if you look at an ocean course, you know, you look at Pebble Beach or Torrey Pines out in California, you know, on the west coast here, you look at those and almost guarantee you that most of those fairways and everything is sloped to go towards the ocean. So that's why your putt and your shots are going to break that way. And so it's absolutely 100% designed that way. And if they don't, are the courses that you see flooded and that unfortunately sometimes have to close down because some of those things, you know, if they're outdated, they're outdated. But if it's a design flaw, that's why if you don't think about drainage and you get a heavy rain, it doesn't matter how good your design is.
I was recently in San Diego just a couple weeks ago and got to play both Torrey Pines North and South on picture-perfect days. I mean, it was mid-80s. There was no wind. There was no fog, you know, because La Jolla could be completely socked in fog and have a lot of wind coming in off the ocean. I mean, there was so little wind that there were no hang gliders off the, you know, flying around that day. Mm. That's how beautiful it was for us. But I found that on the par three on the south course was at number three, which is their signature hole, and then on the north course is a par three number six, which may have been the hardest par three I've ever played in my life, because the rough is so thick on those courses, they just grab a hold of the club head and just hang on to it. But the green sloped back towards the tee box, which was away from the water. It was like the water was behind it, but the green sloped backwards towards us. So it was a completely different orientation there.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I know. That's just one of those characteristics, yeah.
Yeah. So what can we – no, I'll word it this way. How important is it for us to understand golf architecture and the nuances that – like, say, a Gary Player or a Pete Dye or a Robert Trent Jones or a Fazio, their nuances in design, how can that, knowing that information, lower our scores?
Well, I think it's just, you know, like I told you, it's looking at golf as a chess game. Now, if you know your partner, you know, the guy you're playing against in chess, it's going to make it a little bit easier. Well, for me in that case, it's knowing your designer. So, you know, people have played, you know, Pete Dye. We have the Sawgrass coming up, you know, in a couple of weeks here. So you look at that and his characteristics very often. He's known for his railroad ties. He's also known for his demanding par threes. You know, look at the 17th of Sawgrass. But he's also known, I call them moguls, you know, originally being from up north. You have snow moguls. Little humps and bumps and hills everywhere else. So once you play a couple Pete Dye courses, or you know, if your home course is a Nicklaus or a Pete Dye or Gary Player, and you start to notice these things, you're going to go to that other golf course that you haven't played before and notice it's the same designer. Well, most likely you're going to, well, not most likely, guaranteed, you're going to see a lot of similar characteristics from the bunker placement to the bunker shaping to the undulations on the green, and then probably some of the layout of the holes, because once it's worked and they continue to redesign and get contracts for new golf courses, well, something's working. And so, you know, the par fives, sometimes if you see a dogleg right at your home course with a bunker at the corner, you may go play another course that with from the same designer that has a similar aspect. And you say, well, that, I remember that. That looks pretty similar. Now, you, of course, you'll have water versus desert or, you know, what have you, but you're going to recognize some of those things. So I think, you know, it's like playing chess and knowing your opponent when you know a little bit of the course designer. Does it guarantee you're going to win? No, but I certainly think, you know, I certainly think it's going to help your chances. Yeah.
When you said Pete Dye has railroad ties, literally, when you said that, I'm not sure what you mean. Like,
yeah,
literally railroad ties?
Yeah, the giant wood planks that are 1 foot by 1 foot in width, and then probably, gosh, 6 to 8 feet long. And he uses them in a ton of different characteristics. Whether it's, you know, in our case, we have a lot of water features. And so instead of, you know, the grass going right up to the water, he has kind of the grass held up by railroad ties going all along our water features. Also, some steps up to tee boxes are railroad ties. And some bunker features are also the slopes of some bunkers surrounding the bunker has some railroad ties as well. And if you, you know, look at the 17th of Sawgrass, or if you really look at some of Pete Dye's designs, and someone who, you know, appreciates design will tell you, oh, he's, yeah, this is Pete Dye, or it looks like a Pete Dye because there's railroad ties everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's just, I don't know where he began doing that or what happened with that, but I do know that it's a feature that he loves and continues to do. You know, the course was built 25 years ago to today. The courses he's still designing, he uses those railroad ties.
And what about Gary Player? Is there something that is like, oh, that's a Gary Player course? You look at it and you know.
Yeah. For me, it's our rock features and our waterfalls. He really likes using the surrounding environment. He didn't move a lot of dirt around. The land was already here and gently sloping, I'll call it. But what he did is take, you know, the mountains and everything that's right, you know, near us. There's a lot of rock formations and things. And so he took the natural surroundings and put them right into the design of the golf course. So as you stand on the Pete Dye and you see those railroad ties around a lake and it's, you know, it's a nice looking feature, I think you look at the Gary Player at that same feature and he has, I'll call them boulders and rock faces and some waterfalls doing the same thing. And it's kind of, it looks natural because it is natural. And it's and that to me is a Gary Player signature, is using the terrain that he has and really making it feel like you're not just playing the golf course, but you're playing the environment.
Interesting. I've heard that said about the Greg Norman course, is that he doesn't move a lot of dirt. He'll use the natural terrain and built the course through that.
Yeah. Yeah, I tell you, if you can, when you go play any golf course, whether it's our Gary Player or you go play, like you said, a Greg Norman or anybody, and they're boasting the fact that they didn't move a lot of dirt in this project and it's a natural terrain, most of the time you're going to have a very unique property because it's not going to be their typical design. You know, if you have a flat piece of land and the course owner says, I want it to look like this, and they do that with their own twist on it, where, say, well, I want to leave it an autobahn area, or I want to leave it natural. I don't want you to move much dirt. I really like what we have going here. And what you find is it's like telling an artist kind of the canvas that you want to work off of, mm-hmm. versus just giving them a blank sheet. And so I actually prefer playing some of the courses that did move a lot of dirt because it's very unique. You feel like you're playing against the land and not the designer.
Yeah, there was. I played Mayakoba down in Mexico on the eastern side of Mexico at the end of last year, and on the first fairway, there is a cave in the middle of the fairway that when they were designing the course, there was just all these leaves in the middle of, you know, what they were, you know, clearing out to be this to be a fairway. And so the tractor went over to pick up the leaves and fell into the cave. They didn't realize.
Really?
It was just completely filled. Actually, I have a video of it on Golf Smarter TV, which is our YouTube channel, but it's also on golfsmarter.com. We have our video there, and you can see this cave right in the middle of the first fairway. I have a video of that. It's really, that was like, that's an interesting design feature right there.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you, and if you, I haven't mentioned this yet, but our resort is managed, the golf courses are managed by Troon Golf. And the first thing that popped in my head when you said a cave in the middle of the fairway is the Monument Golf Course at Troon North. Because you step on that tee box, I think it's number one or number, I think it's number two. And there's a giant boulder that there's no way could have been moved to be put in the middle of the fairway, but they designed around it. So the Monument Golf Course, I think it's number two, and you hit a tee shot directly in the middle of the fairway is a boulder that's the size of a bus. And it's a very unique feature, but it's one of those things where, like you said, you remember the cave, you remember that boulder, and here you remember the rock features. And so it's very unique and it's very fun. Yeah, I agree with that.
Earlier this year, we had a Golf Smarter adventure down to Scottsdale with some of the listeners, and we went and played, actually, I think, the Pinnacle Course on Troon North, which I found challenging but a lot of fun and really beautiful. I like that course a lot.
When you get up to North Scottsdale and the desert and everything else, it's excellent. I love it up there.
Yeah. I mean, we played four Scottsdale courses. It was great. And we played the TPC Stadium course just a couple days after the Open was finished. So all the grandstands were up. It was awesome. We had such a great time. So on a Nicklaus course, what do you say? Oh, this is a Nicklaus course.
The greens. Simply put, almost any Nicklaus course has greens that you get your head scratching a little bit. And I don't know if it's if it's because he likes Augusta so much, or I don't really know, but if you ever go play a Nicklaus course after it's been done recently, the greens are just often very undulating, very difficult. You know, you look at the Ritz-Carlton where they had the Accenture Match Play this year, for example. The first year that they had it, they kept the greens at a very slow 9, 9.5 on the stint meter because the greens were so sloping and it got windy and got even more difficult for the professionals. Well, the rumor was, you know, I've never personally been down there, but the rumor was after that tournament, it was so difficult that they actually had to go back in, brand new golf course, they had to go back in and make the greens more playable and take out all the humps and bumps. And so whenever I play Nicklaus course, I get my putting shoes on because I know it's going to be pretty undulated most of the time.
There's a course where I live locally, Peacock Gap, and a couple of years ago, architect Forrest Richardson came in and did a redesign of the course. And the course was never that difficult. It's a short course. The joke was that the tee boxes were undulated and the greens were not. You know, you couldn't find a flat spot to tee off from. But after Forrest Richardson finished, he made a lot of not only undulations in the greens, but it made some really strange, like he put a huge dimple in one. He put like a gully through the middle of a green. So you had to know, actually there's two greens that have these gullies in the middle of them. So you had to know in advance, and they're blind greens, on which side you had to hit on that gully. I mean, so interestingly enough, I had the chance to play the course with Jesse Ortiz, the golf club maker.
Yeah.
And he's saying that he grew up on that golf course, but he really enjoyed playing it now because even though it's a short course and it's just, you know, if you want to really boost your ego when you play that course, he says, but you got to have a great short game for that course because you got to know where to place the ball onto the green or it's a 3-putt green easily.
Yeah, that's right. No, I'll tell you, golf course design, if you enjoy it and understand it, there's so many books on it. I mean, even in our Pete Dye Resort Golf Shop, I mean, we have a book that was written by Pete Dye on his designs, and I've read a couple by Jack Nicklaus. And if you really start to read it, it just takes golf to a different aspect, because it's, to me, it's similar to that of if you watch baseball and the game within a game, the pitcher and the batter, mm-hmm. It's like that on a golf course. You step up to that tee box and all of a sudden it's a game within a game. You're trying to have a good number, but how are you supposed to get there? And it's, sometimes understanding the design really helps.
That's so interesting. Or going to a museum and you can go and look at all the different paintings, or you can go to a museum of one artist and just study their work. So cool.
Yeah, it is. I love it. I really enjoy course design.
And are there other courses that you've worked at that have special, unique designs that are soft spot in your heart?
Yeah, I think I'll tell you, like I mentioned before, I had a chance to spend some time with Jack Nicklaus. Mm. And I was with Troon Golf at a club in western Nebraska in the Sand Hills called Dismal River.
Really? And, Dismal? Dismal, like, oh, my God. Dismal River?
Dismal River, and it's an actual river that runs through the golf course, so they just named it right after that. And I guess the name actually came from an aquifer that bubbled up, and it never got, the river never went up or down, no matter how much rain they did or didn't get.
So
the locals in 1800s called it Dismal, so they just kept the name. So, but anyway, I told you Jack Nicklaus's greens are often pretty undulating and those type of things. Well, he came out to do a redesign in our course, and part of it was very undulating greens, and but walking the golf course with him, 18 holes, and then sitting down that night and that evening and having dinner with him and listening to him talk about golf course design, really definitely, like you said, kind of I have a soft spot for. That was a really neat experience. I also had a chance to work at Oakland Hills Country Club up in Michigan, and Reese Jones came out to do a redesign before the 2008 PGA Championship. And that was the first time I've actually had any experience with any course design. And one of the golf professionals hit the ball a mile. He hit it really far. And in the first tee box at Oakland Hills Country Club on the South Course, which is where they play the event, Reese moved some dirt around to have a first tee box right next to the patio where the members would usually sit at. And we're feet away from the brick pavers for the clubhouse. And so he pushed it back as far as he could. And they had marked out where they wanted to put a bunker, and they moved some dirt around. And so the shape of the bunker was there, and the shape of this dirt tee box was padded down. So one of the golf professionals goes out to the tee box, who hits it a long way. He probably hits it between 320 yards. He's a good college player. And he hit a tee shot until he hit it good. And when he did, he got on the radio and said, "I hit that one well." And well, he cleared the existing bunker that Reese had put in there. And so immediately went right back to the blueprint, the drawing board. The next day, the bunkers were 20 yards further out.
Wow.
And it's really neat to, Reese Jones, Jack Nicklaus, and then coming and really enjoying course design, like here at the Pete Dye and Gary Player. You go through some of those experiences, and it's just, it's kind of a second calling or a niche that that you enjoy. So those are some courses that I really liked, and certainly no exception out here. I'll tell you, there's – the Coachella Valley in Southern California here in the desert, it's a saturation of golf courses. And I think,
The Palm Springs area, which is like the retirement area, the Florida type of the West Coast, where so many retire. Yeah. So there's a lot of golf courses there.
A lot of golf. Yeah. And, having a four diamond resort and Troon Golf managed golf courses, not only, we're not the only two Troon courses down here. We have Indian Wells and Classic Club. And so guests who appreciate, being a member for a day and what Troon has to offer will play our two courses and go over, play Classic Club 18 holes and go play the 36 that Indian Wells has to offer. Hmm. And all of a sudden you've got a week of golf there. Some really good golf courses. So
yeah, well, Classic Club, Brady Wilson was just on the show recently and talked about that course as well. And I'm sure that if anybody's been listening to this program on a regular basis, they know what I feel about Troon Golf. I just love Troon Golf, the way they manage a course. And it's, they treat you like a member for the day. I just love, and it's always the condition of the course is always spectacular. No question about it.
Well, I mean, between agronomy, basically growing grass and maintaining the grass and the playing surfaces, to the level of service, it's really important that there's a consistency, whether you play, you know, in Oregon at Pronghorn, or you go out to Hawaii and play tune courses out there to the desert, or even in Florida, or even internationally. There has to be a level of consistency, and that's something that a lot of people like and appreciate. You know, that's why a lot of people like being a member for a day with Shroom Golf. Just like if you're a Westin Rewards member, you know, you want to stay at hotels that have a consistent service and consistent, sure. You know, it's the same thing with Shroom, being a golf management company.
Awesome. Awesome. You know, we can talk about architects for so much longer. Yeah. You mentioned Reese Jones, who is probably the, what is it like, either royalty or even the Kennedys of golf course design. It's just that family, right? It's Reese Jones, Robert Trent Jones Jr., Robert Trent Jones Sr.
He is the open doctor. Exactly.
And do each of them have unique features to their courses? You can walk on and go, oh, that's a Reese Jones. Oh, that's a Robert Trent Jr. Oh, that. Or is it pretty much that's a Jones course? Are they all similar?
Well, I think each of them have their own characteristic to a golf course. Certainly, it isn't as definitive as railroad ties or rock features or things like that. But it could be little things. You know, one may really prefer a square tee box, you know, where it's perfectly square, or another may like a tee box that follows the shape of the hole. Little things like that. And I'm not sure 100% as to, you know, what little characteristic each of them do different, but I can guarantee you that I'm sure they want to separate themselves a little bit from each other and say, yeah, this is where I like to go with my designs, as they're probably similar. You know, you're going to get a similar product, but I'm sure there's a little quirks here and there that are their own.
Yeah. Well, this is a Golf Smarter for Members Only episode, and the members of this, if they haven't already, I was really honored to be able to spend an hour sitting down with Robert Trent Jones Jr., actually because I was doing a video project for Troon Golf. And so they flew me out to New York to sit down with Robert Trent Jones to interview him to put in the video. So they should go back, you know, listeners should definitely go back and listen to that hour of speaking to Robert Trent Jones, because it was awesome. And then actually very early on in Golf Smarter episodes, Jim Fazio, I sat down with him for another video project that I was doing for Troon for the Country Club of Oxford. So, yeah, I love Troon. I will not hide behind that. They've been good to me, and I'll do my best to get it back. Yeah. Hey, Jeff, this has really, really been interesting. I think it's a very different way to look at golf courses, and I really appreciate the education. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Oh, gosh, my pleasure. And I just hope that, you know, the people who are listening to the program kind of take this and instead of just going to play golf, a little bit different appreciation for exactly what goes behind golf course design. And like it happened with me, it's a second niche and a second calling. If I could go back and do it over, I might look at doing golf course design instead of being a golf professional. But people can take this to the first tee and see if they see it a little bit differently now.
Yeah, I don't think we'll ever look at it the same way after this. Thanks so much, buddy.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks, Fred.
Coming up next, PGA Tour player and top-ranked instructor Stan Utley returns to talk about his new book, The Art of the Swing. And not to get left behind, but now we've got a Facebook like button on our homepage. Please let others in your network know that you're a regular listener and visitor to golfsmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.